Data DevOps with the SQL team.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host. We're helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using everything the .NET ecosystem has to offer. And I and others are doing a ton of online user group speaking. So if you run a .NET or Azure-related user group, I'd love to give a presentation for you. Just send me an email. And today's episode is sponsored by ClearMeasure, and they make this podcast happen. They're a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results. So if they can help, please get in touch. And also be sure to check out the new video show that I've recently launched called Architect Tips, small bite-sized 5 to 7 minute videos on a particular topic. Now for today's show, we have two guests, and I'm excited for this. We have Arvind from the Azure SQL DB product management team and Drew from the SQL Tools and Experiences team. And I'll ask you both to kind of dive into what more you do in your team. So welcome to the show. Glad to have you.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Now, Arvind, your team, the Azure SQL DB product management team, what does that team do, and how long have you been on it, and what did you do before joining the team?
Sure. So the Azure SQL DB PM team, that's the way we usually refer to it here, is a group of program managers, more specifically product managers in the popular popularly accepted lingo. So we have a bunch of folks on our team, each of whom own a specific feature from the customer-facing point of view. We have our engineering counterparts, of course, who actually write the code and deliver it in the service and so on. But broadly speaking, our group of PMs is the customer-facing side of the business. We work with customers, make sure we understand what they really need, and shape that into requirements, work with our engineering teams to make sure we stage the delivery of features out to the cloud and to the box product, if you may, for SQL Server as well. In terms of specializations, my primary focus is Azure SQL DB Hyperscale, which is a service tier and one of our premium offerings in the cloud. Apart from that, I also have a couple of other additional responsibilities, one of which is the graph features within Azure SQL and SQL Server, so the ability to work with nodes and edges and graph data structures, basically. And last, but definitely not the least, I work on DevOps-related scenarios. So Drew is conceptually the owner of that area of the business, but given my background in the field, working with a lot of breadth scenarios on data pipelines and so on, I tend to do a lot of interfacing on real-world customer scenarios, like securing pipelines. How do you, orchestrate more complicated workflows involving infrastructure element and the database side of the business? So, yeah, couple of hats. Hopefully that helps you visualize.
Yeah, that's a lot. Well, Drew, how is your team different? What do you work on every day?
With the SQL Tools and Experiences team, we are a group of program managers, PMs, similar to Arvind, but instead our focus is generally on client tools or drivers and frameworks around Azure SQL and SQL Server. So in a lot of ways, we're complementary then to Arvind's team and other teams, in that I get to work with someone such as Arvind to work on those DevOps experiences or on client tools like SQL Server Management Studio and Azure Data Studio, and bringing developer experiences, database administrator experiences, and even then the CI/CD pipeline type type environments to life.
Okay, awesome. Well, welcome to you both. Regardless of the tech that we're talking about, the listeners of this show, they come here to figure out, okay, how should I be using this technology and how does it fit into a high-performing development environment for the team? And if anybody's using .NET, somewhere in the system is one or multiple SQL Server databases. It's just always there, regardless if they're using, you know, this piece or that piece or everything else. Every system, you know, always has a SQL Server database. And there's been a lot of conversation over the years about the proper way to deploy a database and the proper way to modify a database schema and then monitoring a database. And so can you give the rundown? What is the current state of the art with how to manage, before we even get to scaling a database, just developing and deploying and running a SQL Server database?
I can kind of set the broader stage, and then Drew, you can chip in with your position as well. So there's multiple options here, and I think you know, broadly two camps, if you may. There's you know, as if you visualize it, there's on one end you have what we call a declarative experience around database development, wherein you specify the end state of the database that you wanted to kind of end up with. And then tooling allows the developer to just, you know, kind of focus on the end state. So the tooling then figures out how to get to that final state. So that's like one camp. The other camp is kind of a migration-based approach where you specify the incremental sets of changes. You as the developer specify the incremental set of changes to get there. So it's like the how as well. So declarative, just to recap, is you specify the what and let the tooling do the how, and the migration-based approach is you specify the how as well. Obviously, both have their pros and cons. So with the migration-based approach comes a lot of power. You get a lot of power to tweak the individual steps that the database takes to get to the final product. It does come with the overhead as well, in the sense you have to manage those intermediate hops. Declarative has the advantage that you just specify the end result, and depending on how good the tooling is, you could end up with a completely hands-off autopilot type experience. At the same time, because it's kind of like, you know, quote-unquote black box, there could be issues which sometimes crop up, wherein, let's say, a particular change is not delivered in the most optimum manner that you would want it to be, and so on. So that's conceptually the two ends of the, you know, the two bookends of the set of options we have there. And there will be hybrid approaches which you could implement in between. I think this is a good segue for Drew to get into some of the specifics from the product point of view, from the tools point of view, what options we present as the first party experience.
Yeah, so as Arvind said, there's the declarative approach that relies a bit more on the tooling to then manage going from the beginning to that end state that you wrote, whereas there's the migration-based approach where you're a lot more hands-on with the pathway and the how. From the tooling perspective, my goal is that the tooling is as good as it can be and give you as much a hands-off and kind of the developer velocity that will allow you to build your application and deploy it quickly. And the declarative approach gets you there faster in most cases. And whenever we see, as Arvind mentioned, sometimes that black box and making sure you're getting the right end result for what you expect, that's where a lot of times DevOps pipelines come into play, and making sure that we have dev test environments set up that we can pass the tooling through and you can do quality assurance and all kinds of approvals along the way. there is certainly always the "it depends" answer for a user and their environment. And so the question always is answered with the first question of what's your current process? What's the environment? You mentioned this is a .NET scenario, but what are the other things at play? And so in some cases, people will not start with the declarative approach. They'll start migration. They'll maybe be a smaller group of developers or be moving very quickly in a way where they don't want to be locked in. But you can go from a migration-based approach to that declarative pathway at any point in your project. You don't have to start there. So you can then bring your database into a database project, into that declarative workflow, either in SQL Server Data Tools or in Azure Data Studio, and then start there and have a little bit easier time with your source control and things like that.
Now, the DAC pack has been around for quite a while in the data project, and that's the one aligned with the declarative approach, correct?
That's correct. What,
is there another tool that's aligned with the migration approach?
I think there's a bunch of options there. So the ones we most commonly encounter, because a lot of it is open source, kind of public domain tooling, there's this tool called DBUP, which I think one of my colleagues, Davide, spoke on your show a couple of weeks ago. He's super passionate about DBUP, and I've used it as well. I think it's the beauty is in the simplicity and elegance. It's pretty robust. There's Flyway, which is from Redgate. I think it's open source as well. We do have a bunch of customers who use Flyway. Again, treat these as kind of just our just our sharing of what we see, not necessarily an official recommendation per se. But sure. I think these are the two most commonly seen options.
So from a strategy perspective, Redgate had SQL source control for a long time, which is the declarative approach. And now from a commercial side, they have Redgate SQL migrations. From Microsoft's tooling, what's the strategy? DACPAC has been around for a long time. Is the strategy to not provide a migrations-based approach, or is there one in the works? And which do you see? Do you see one being the 80 side of the 80-20 rule? Or from the highest strategy level, what are the conversations like within the team?
From the DACPAC, from the DACFX conversation side, we're continuing to invest in that declarative approach. And whatever framework you're using, SQL package or DACPACs with, you're going to continue to see improvements, whether things that I work with Arvind on, like graph support, continues to be a part of that roadmap. There are also other frameworks that are coming into play that have libraries associated with them. For example, the framework around Django and SQL Server or Azure SQL was just updated, and there's an open source library for it now. And that library's approach is migration-based. And we are working on that and contributing to open source in that way. There are a lot of, as Arvind mentioned, open source projects contributing to that migration-based approach, and we're not ignoring them, or we are investing in them in some ways, but it's not a part of the roadmap for DACFX that is continuing to get investment in the declarative approach.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
So if someone uses DBUP, do they still use a Visual Studio database project, or is that an either-or decision?
Generally speaking, it's a .NET project. If you're working with framework or with core, it would typically be a .NET core or .NET framework project. And then you reference, if I remember correctly, you reference the package, the NuGet for DBUP, and then you add code, which is typically C# code or the language of the choice, which which calls DB up to actually affect the migration. So you specify a folder, if I remember correctly, where you store your .sql file, which are numbered in a particular, it's numbered in sequence of your migration action. It is the developer's responsibility then to make sure those actions are idempotent, i.e. they do not error out if they happen to be rerun. They also have to handle transactions if they want to roll back stuff which went wrong and so on. So there's a bit of work from the developer perspective to make sure that all these are in the right sequence, if you may, and in the right structure for DBUP to do its magic. I do like the fact that DBUP maintains a table within the database where it stores the list of changes that were done with the timestamp, if I remember correctly, and so on. So yeah, that's what I know about DBUP. I've used it a few times, and I like the simplicity. But I think going back to that thing which Drew mentioned, mixing and matching, and I overheard this term recently, there's this inner loop, which is a tight sequence of modifying code, testing it out, and so on. Absolutely, we would, even I would use like local client management studio or Azure Data Studio, prototype things very quickly, figure out how that goes. And then the outer loop, which is more of the formal software development process. You have a PR, goes up for code review. All of that could be done with a declarative, like a SQL project approach. One last thing before I stop, and I think I'm, if you ask me, which of the two do I prefer, I like both. As I said, I personally also mix and match. But one of the, really powerful things with the declarative approach is that the entire state of the database is visible in a single pane of glass, if you may. So that opens up some very powerful capabilities in the area of static code analysis, for example. So just like a .NET project, you could do stuff like what Roslyn does. We have our own code analysis engine within DACFX, which allows us to run static code analysis checks. So you could spot issues before they actually come up in a runtime environment. And I think for a migration-based approach to implement similar level of fidelity in terms of the richness of static code analyzers is a lot tougher. So we see, sometimes there are options out there again for the migration-based approach where you have more free-form text-based analyzers which look for certain query patterns using regexes and stuff like that. Sometimes they pop up false positives. And comparatively, a formal type system that DACFX has and the parser that we ship internally for DACFX, because it's robust, the tendency for false positives to arise with the declarative-based SQL project when it comes to code analysis is lower. So I think that's one of the things that, in my opinion, swings this outer loop towards more formal methods, like what the SQL project ecosystem with DACFX gives you.
Okay. Drew, you had mentioned Azure Data Studio, and that's one of the newer tools. What does the landscape right now look like for tooling around managing your SQL Server database? SQL Management Studio has been around for a long time. Way back in the day, it was what called SQL Enterprise Studio or Enterprise Manager or something like that. What are the tools that people should be using right now, and what are each one geared towards?
I think right now there are plenty of tools. You notice you mentioned that there's the newer one in Azure Data Studio. If you're coming towards SQL Server as more of a developer, you might be coming towards it from VS Code. And so there's an extension for VS Code that gives you query history and kind of that Object Explorer, and that's the MS SQL extension for VS Code. You might be in Visual Studio using SQL Server data tools. You mentioned SSMS or SQL Server Management Studio. There's a broad umbrella of first-party Microsoft SQL tools, and it's complementary to in the last couple of years, the addition of SQL Server in containers, the options for SQL on Azure, whether it's Azure SQL Database or Managed Instance. So there are tools to fit more scenarios as more and more people are able to come and leverage Azure SQL. Azure Data Studio and VS Code are cross-platform applications. So if you are using .NET Core on macOS or Linux, there's a SQL management interface for you, either Azure Data Studio or in VS Code. And they're also available on Windows, but then you also have the options of Visual Studio and SQL Server Management Studio. Everything I've mentioned is currently being maintained and updates are being shipped. There's a lot more velocity around Azure Data Studio right now with different extensions coming in for different experiences, whether it's notebooks and manageability in terms of kind of scripting out your environment, or it's the developer experience with SQL database projects in Azure Data Studio. So there's a lot going on, and it's almost hard to keep up sometimes, I think. And I hope that helps people get excited in not only are there a lot of great features coming into the engine, but we're also trying to make things more accessible for users to come to Azure SQL.
The investment is awesome. With the name Azure Data Studio, what's the strategy there? It wasn't called Azure SQL Studio. Is it really geared toward every storage service in Azure, or is there a boundary somewhere?
It is not geared towards every Azure data service, but there is not a hard and fast boundary because the data services as they are today are not the same as they were 6 months ago, nor 6 months in the future. And as data services change rapidly and the data services that our users are integrating together change rapidly, we don't want them to find themselves invested in a tool where suddenly they're trying to also bring in Postgres on Azure and then having to learn a new tool, whereas there's currently an extension that allows you to use Postgres in Azure Data Studio. So there's a little bit of ambiguity in that. There's also, you mentioned Azure on the front of the name. Originally in a preview, it was known as SQL Operations Studio. And when it became GA, the name got adjusted. It didn't lose its ability to connect to SQL servers. It's able to connect to SQL Server 2008, 2005, within reason. And so it is a SQL management and connectivity querying tool that happens to have Azure on the name.
Okay, so it really is geared towards the SQL Server engine.
Correct.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, let's move forward to beyond deployment to monitoring and telemetry. You have a SQL Server database running in Azure. What are all the current flavors that people should know about? I think there's been some changes over the past years with serverless versus, do you measure it in DTUs versus, new thing. What's the landscape on how people should decide how to run their SQL database?
Oh, I can take that one. I think there is a breadth of options, and I think that can be daunting and it can be useful to have as well. So if you look at the broadest spectrum, so there's IaaS, PaaS, you could bracket, like you have your own SQL Server, VM running in IaaS. And then on the other side, you have fully managed services like hyperscale, serverless, and so on. In between, you have managed instance, which is a PaaS service, but is bit more geared towards the migration side of the story, wherein you want to bring in a SQL Server workload, you eventually want to get it to a fully managed service, hands-off kind of an experience. So MI, or managed instance, kind of bridges those two worlds between a VM experience and a fully managed service. Even within PaaS, SQL DB, as we call it. When we say SQL DB, it is the PaaS, platform as a service option. It is the managed version of our offerings. And there we do have a bunch of service tiers, which has been daunting. So over time, hopefully, the scenarios kind of tighten up and we make it more seamless for a customer to pick one thing and then we kind of internally figure out what's best for that customer. But that's still a long way away. I think the current landscape is you have serverless and you have provision. I think that's one slice of the matrix that you make. So provisioned is you have it always at a particular compute level. It stays that way. Serverless, which I think Davide also spoke to you about a couple of weeks ago, has this ability to auto-scale and potentially auto-pause after a period of inactivity. Serverless is great for those sporadically used databases where it's you have a burst of activity and then for weeks or days or hours, it's not used at all or used somewhat lesser. There's pools as well, which is the other kind of a different slice on things. So you have provisioned compute, you have serverless, and then you have groups of these databases, which is pools. Pools are generally more cost effective for larger fleets of databases. So typically we have a lot of ISVs, software as a service vendors, including some of our own first party services, which use pools to achieve these cost efficiencies when you're talking about hundreds or thousands of databases in your fleet of DBs. And then there's the other angle, which is the service tier, which is the engine, if you may, behind the scene, corresponding to how SQL Server is actually running. And there again, we have had classically the general purpose tier, which also was referred to in the past as the standard tier. Then you have this business critical tier, which is precisely what the name suggests. It's all SSD storage based and low latency transaction logging and so on. And then, of course, you have hyperscale, which is what I work on most of the time. And hyperscale aims to kind of blend some of the best of the breed from business critical, wherein we aim to provide high performance levels, low latencies for transaction logging, and so on, but closer to the price point of a general purpose or a standard database. And it does that by using a bunch of microservices and sort of a distributed functions for storage, compute, and transaction logging. Honestly speaking, looking forward, hyperscale is where our big investments are, and we are aiming to make it feature complete. We are aiming to add features which enterprise customers need. And at some point, hopefully, hyperscale will have all the other things that we associate with, let's say, general purpose or business critical. But at this point in time, I would say it's mostly there. It doesn't have things like pools. So you can't have a hyperscale pool today. We'll hopefully have that sometime later. It doesn't have some things like zone redundancy, which again is top of mind for us. We are thinking about getting that out as soon as we can. There's a bunch of other incremental features. That gap is narrowing very quickly. I think Davide spoke on your show a few weeks ago, talked about a couple of the other things which we're working on. But overall, I think we're trying to simplify this going forward. But for now, there's a bunch of options. Feel free to ask me more questions if I can clarify.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's really interesting about hyperscale, because a lot of people are going to document databases or Cosmos DB, and the SQL Server engine isn't sitting still. So that's definitely something to watch. Drew, as we close out here, from the tools perspective, what are the things coming up that people should watch out for, or maybe look forward to, going forward in the coming months and year?
We are continuing to, like I mentioned before, have continued investment with Azure Data Studio. So whether it's the notebook space or whether it's SQL projects, there's going to be continued advancements, especially in terms of the SQL Server data tools in Visual Studio and the breadth of features that are there. Those are still going to be brought into Azure Data Studio to help bring parity to that experience. Like I mentioned, we want to make sure that users that are cross-platform are able to use some of the rich functionality around code analysis and the rest of the SQL project's interface. So it's an exciting time to be a SQL developer.
All right. For listeners who are not yet using Azure Data Studio, download it. Before we leave, for listeners who kind of want to dig in a little bit more, are there any go-to resources, websites, training that you would encourage them to point their browsers towards?
Right now, we've been releasing a number of modules on Microsoft Learn that walk through some really tremendous tutorials that will help you come up to speed as either a DBA or a developer on Microsoft SQL. And one of the really fantastic things beyond the great content is the Azure sandbox that comes along with it. So you can get hands-on with the content right there immediately without needing to dive into a full subscription.
Nice, nice. And that's learn.microsoft.com. Is there any keyword that they should search for?
It's going to be under Azure SQL Fundamentals.
Okay. Arvind, do you have any go-to resources that you'd like to plug?
Sounds good. I think what Drew mentioned is a great starting point. The specific to DevOps, covering some of these, contrasting the different approaches and deep diving into some of the specifics. I'm quite passionate about securing DevOps pipelines, and one of the things I love to do is to try to use Azure first-party features like Azure Active Directory authentication and so on. So if you just look for data exposed, there's a nice series of videos which feature a number of my colleagues. I've done two webcasts on the data exposed series, both of which are specifically talking about these two approaches. So the declarative approach and the migration-based approach. And you'll see some of those elements around using Azure AD, securing your pipelines and so on out there. So data exposed, DevOps, I think are the keywords.
Awesome. All right. Well, a lot of good information. Arvind and Drew, thank you both for coming on the show and sharing us what you are working on the Azure SQL DB product team, as well as the SQL tools and experience team. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. And thanks again for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, my pleasure. And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.